You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Peaches Gillette. Peaches, it's good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
So the way the show starts is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about the life you aspire to live, some of the labels you wear, some of the things you've done? What do we need to know to just start this conversation?
Yeah, I think I'll start with the fact that I am an educator, an early childhood educator. And right now I'm teaching language arts and poetry at the College Initiative Upstate program up in Ithaca. And that is, I think that's my big draw in life, is being around children, young people, or people who are struggling in the academic field. So I really love that. I've worked as a chaplain. I studied pastoral care and counseling in Fordham University. And I work as a counselor for people who are incarcerated. And I think the fortunate thing is that I've always been able to, or somehow it's been brought to me, that I'm always plugged into something that I deeply love doing. And that's really been a blessing for me. I'm really glad about that.
So you need to be grounded in your life.
Yeah. I'm also a poet, so that's a fun thing for me. And that's about it.
Okay, well, that will get us started. And you brought music with you. What music should we open the show with?
I think I'd like to hear Tracy Chapman.
Okay, and that is Be and Be Not Afraid?
Yes, yes.
And do you want to say anything about it before we play it, or just play it?
Yeah, no, I'd like to, if that's okay.
Yes, absolutely.
But it was important to me. It was so interesting. I was driving this long road one winter, and it wasn't just beautiful, but there was something very lonely and haunting about it. And I was flipping through the radio station. I heard this Tracy Chapman song that I literally had never heard before. And it had this really amazing rhythm that just flowed with every inch of movement and the snow and the twinkling stars. And I just fell in love with the song, and the words as well mean something to me.
That's really neat. Here we go.
I believe in mistakes and accidents, that the nature of life is chaos and confusion. The man's rules of law and order may not stand, and I should be and be not afraid to reach for heaven. Think that I know the true hearts and needs. My pride may bring me low, unable to see. I'm no closer than yesterday. Tomorrow I may stand, be and be not afraid to reach for heaven. Thank you. I'll see the black car cavalcade. Lights on in the morn. I'll run fast and far away. I'll run without stopping till heart and feet fail, or until I can't stand the end. Be not afraid.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Peaches Gillette. So Peaches, to go where I like to go next is with this question: what are some of the things you had to experience, you had to live through, to know how to live the life you value now?
Yeah, I think that it began with a combination of things. And both of them, one was racism and one was poverty. And I feel like those were the real elements that molded who I was. I also, part of what has made me who I am is that my mother was 50 when she had me. So she was an older mother. Right. By the time I was like 10 years old. She was actually the age of my friend's grandparents. And there was something about her nature and her being so close to her own history that she passed on to me, and I feel like I absorbed in my life, that made me who I am. She was a very compassionate woman, a very loving woman, a very forgiving woman, and really, really worked hard to teach us that our connections with other people, no matter who they are, what they are, what color they are, was one of the most valuable things that we could experience in life. And that stayed with me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So history is a long fabric of connection, a tapestry of connection. How did she introduce you to carry history, to live history, to build on history? How did she make that available to you?
She actually told us stories all the time about her childhood. And there were eight of us, and I was on the last end of it. So I had a brother who was about 24 years older than I was. And he also passed on the history. He was the one who came up. She hitchhiked up to New York City in 1942 with him. I think he was six at the time. And so there, it was almost like they had this beautiful, unbreaking story about their life and their travels during that time and how they got up here. And he always told us stories about that, told us stories about being day workers and picking cotton and how harsh it was down there.
And where was down there?
Down in, she grew up in Maryland, but ended up going further down south because there was more work.
Right.
And then I guess at some point in her life, she realized, you know, let me go further north and get more work. So she grew up down south. She spent most of her time down south, literally. Even she was born in 1911, still picking cotton and working the fields and picking strawberries and things like that. And I think that's how she saved up to get up to New York City and start her life.
And she got to New York City in 1942.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. And I just love the image. Like I love the image of this, like this single black woman with this little boy in a time where you had to really worry about your life in a way that I've never experienced, even though I've had those kind of incidents, who took it upon herself just because she wanted a better life for herself and her kid to brave this territory and get up here and do something different with her life.
Right. And so my sense then, the stories then become what she did in particular moments or what happened around her in the immediate moments and not larger stories of family systems or my guess is that your notion of history is the personal agency of a human being in the midst of poverty and racism.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And her stories are so interesting when it comes to race and racism and its history in and of itself. Pieces get filled in just by things you see in the world, whether it's through movies or other people's stories, and all these pieces get filled in even with your imagination. Like I always grew up loving the country, even though it was harsh for her. There was something enchanting about when she was a child being able to be in fields and doing things like that. And that also kind of got worked itself into who I am as a person.
Right. And when you're in farming life, your life is dictated by the weather and the mm-hmm. soil conditions and mm-hmm. everything, and you feel it in a really powerful way. Mm-hmm. I'm the seventh of eight children. and there's a 20-year age span between the oldest and youngest.
I love it.
And my mother and father were born in 1921, so they were 10 mm-hmm. years younger than your mother. And that,
yeah, it's amazing. And all those every story she told was really a story of survival. I mean, it really was. It was just something that I was impressed with and in awe with as a child. Because, you know, as a child, your survival is not conscious to you. You are doing survival by being poor and getting through racism, things like that. But when someone else is telling you the story, you're thinking like, she seemed like a superhero to me in some ways, because of the harshness that she'd gone through. And the fact that she came out of it still being a loving, solid person, which was another thing that made her seem like a hero to me.
So when you have a parent who is cast in your life as a hero, part of growing up is separating from that parent and taking off on your own course. How did you navigate the bearing both the wonder and the weight of all those stories and find yourself?
You know, it's interesting because I was one, and it could have been because I was the youngest. It could have been because I feel like some people come in this world with a certain kind of temperament that attracts mm-hmm. them to certain things.
Sure.
And I was very attracted, in an interesting way, very attracted to suffering because of the story she told me, and love. And so I kind of grew into myself more than finding myself.
Right,
because it was slow, beautiful, slow, poetic development of taking all the information I had from her, taking all the things I imagined about her, mm-hmm. and kind of weaving them together and going, yeah, you know, as a child, you spend part of your life trying to figure out, like, which character do I want to be in this world, you know?
Right.
And so what it did was it sculpted a character that felt so right to me I just took it on, you know?
Mm-hmm. My dad died when I was 7, almost 8. And when I was around 12, I had this very powerful dream. And my mother suffered from depression and anxiety. And, you know, she was left with 3 kids still to raise at home. And when he died, and I realized that she would never have chosen that her mother die when she was 12, after 5 years of being bedridden with cancer, and that she would never have chosen to lose her husband, my father, and she would never have chosen to lose the baby who was born before me, for whom I was basically born to replace on some level. And my need for her was to be compassionate to her rather than rebel against her. And that was came very clear to me. Now, there are some helpful things about rebelling, and not having done that, I had to have had to work out relationships with women in different sorts of ways because of that. But I could not add misery to her suffering.
I completely am on board with that, because I always felt like there was a part of me that always felt like I wished I could have made her life easier. That was just the bottom line. I wish I could have made her life easier. I wish I were there when she was a child, you know, that maybe I would have been friends with her, you know, something. That would
have could have made it easier.
Yeah, exactly. And all are so amazing. It's just like these beautiful puzzle pieces, and they all become me at a point. And I was the one who was always like, I remember like not wanting to go to school just because I wanted to stay home with her. Just because we weren't even doing anything. My mother was very quiet. I just wanted to be in her presence all her the presence, time.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take it that presence is one of the puzzle pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some of those puzzle pieces, and when did you realize that one of your major life tasks is to put them together?
I can't really say. I'll think about it a little more, but I'm not sure if I ever realized it.
I just did it. It
happened.
Yeah.
You know, I think that it just kind of like, I think that what happens is like, it kind of just happens. It get put together. And then you go, oh, wow, I'm that kind of person. You know, like, I didn't really think deeply about like, am I that kind of person? I'm living that way.
Right.
And then realize like, oh, I am that kind of person. And I'm true to that. You know, I'm not doing things because I want to be liked or because I want to be popular. I really feel connected to people in a way that makes me want to be there for them.
Right, right. So what I sense, even deeper than emotion, deeper than intellect, but deeper than emotion, is a visceral connection to folks that it's what I understand it to be, is you learn how to live out of gracefulness rather than choice.
Yeah.
And it's a movement towards others, and it's a movement within yourself. And I imagine that it's also a stirring at times from time to time.
Oh yeah. And it's in some ways, I mean, I wouldn't change it for the world, but in some ways it's very depressing. It brings you down in a way, because my thoughts are always like, I want people to not suffer.
Right.
What can I do to help them feel like they're suffering less, or mitigate or something? So sometimes I sit and I think like, what more can I do? What else can I do for this individual or for the world? You know, so sometimes it's heavy. It's a heavy load.
What I got from your telling the story of your mother, it's not a load that you carry alone.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it is a heavy load.
Yeah.
But it's in a relationship. I imagine that you were a very intense child.
Yeah.
So how did this shape your friendships?
It was interesting. I was intense, and I only know that because I was told that a million times in my young life. I didn't even know what it meant to be intense, but I was just told I was intense. So that became the label. What in some ways, what it does is it filters your friendships. And the people you end up being around are the people who really want to be around you. So in some ways, none of my friends were ever superficial, because once people saw that in me, they either went, okay, no way. Or they went, okay, I get this, and I could be there with this person. Right. So it really almost clarified in kind of the cooking sense, clarified my relationships, you know?
What should we play next?
Let's play Michigan for the summer. I mean, Michigan for the winter, sorry.
Michigan for the winter, Ryan Hurd. And did you want to say anything before we play that?
Yeah, I have, it's so interesting. And that I've always loved folk music, always, all my life. My mother My mother liked folk music. I remember the few times she would have the radio on, it would be folk music or something in between folk and a soft rock. That's outside of the church music she liked. So for me, folk music connected me back to her countryside. So suddenly, so slowly, I'm somebody who loves to be on the road. If you gave me a map and said, just go, that's what I would do. And music keeps me company on the road. Mm-hmm. So I started listening to a country radio station called The Highway. And I heard this song, and I've always loved Michigan. I always wanted to go to Michigan because I love the cold. And this song came on, and it was so sweet and such a love song. And I thought, okay, that's the song I love for the road.
Beautiful. Thank you.
I need a change of scene till the seasons change. Maybe longer nights, maybe shorter days will get me over what I can't get past. If you're gone and you won't come back, maybe a little space or a little time somewhere far from here will get you off my mind. I can't stay watching you move on all February long. I'm going to Michigan for the winter. Between the dark and the light of the sky and the snow, most people go south for the weather instead of hiding out in the cold. But just in case you wanna change your mind, I'm letting you know where you can find me. 46th Street, that first right turn down a dirt road, watching that wood stove burn. I'm either waiting at your memory or for you to never comes first. Until it don't hurt no more, I'll be up north. I'm going to Michigan for the winter. I'm going to Michigan. This 7 hour long empty rear view drive isn't what I want, but I guess it's time to say goodbye to the way things were and finally come to terms. But just in case you wanna change your mind, I'm letting you know where you can find me. 46th Street, that first right turn down a dirt road, watching that wood stove burn. I'm either waiting at your memory or for you to wanna come back to me. Whichever comes first, until it don't hurt. Dark and the light of the sky and the snow. Most people go south for the weather, but I just wanna be alone. Just in case you wanna change your mind, I'm letting you know where you can find me. 46th Street, that first right turn down a dirt road, watching that wood stove burn. While I'm waiting at your memory, girl, you know. Chair with a Bible or a beer till my heart don't hurt no more. I'm going to Michigan for the winter. Yeah, I'm going to Michigan for the winter.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Peaches Gillette. How has life surprised you and turned out differently than you might have expected, or how have you had to change in ways that you wouldn't have anticipated?
I think what has surprised me is when I was a child, I was similar to my mother, very quiet, very shy, lacked a lot of confidence, basically because of racism and always, you know, growing up in the 60s in a white neighborhood. I grew up in Park Slope, was not easy. Always being put last, put behind, put down, told you're limited, whatever. And it took many years for me to realize that what I was told about myself never matched up to what I thought about myself. And I was allowed to think about myself in the way that worked for me. In other words, as a child, I thought that I had to think about myself in the way that people told me, the adults told me. So I got kind of drawn into it and almost drowned by it for years. And I was surprised as I slowly came to terms with, you know what, I am a decent person and I can accomplish things in this life. And how I see myself is really, really what's important. And I did see myself in another way, but I thought I wasn't allowed to. And once I realized that I was allowed to see myself as who I was, I became much stronger in the world.
Do you remember what was happening with you, or what the process or occasion was when you began to allow yourself to see yourself as you did?
You know, it's so interesting because it's a very sad story to me. But anyway, I shared this story one time. It came out of me because when I started getting really angry at the way I saw other people treated because of racism. And I remember having many stories, but the story that really stands out to me is a story about my friend Eric Siegel, who was treated so poorly because he was one of the few Jews in Park Slope at the time. And their family was still kind of on the verge of kind of hiding it. And when people found out he was Jewish, he was basically tortured by the other children in the neighborhood and their parents. And I remember that it broke my heart all the time. And Eric and I were like the best friends in the world. We were like, if Eric and I were grown-ups, we would have been married in 2 seconds. We just loved each other instantly. And I remember thinking, I cannot allow this. I cannot allow this. No matter what fears I have to rise above that. And I have to stand by his side and help him with this. And that was a big part of what made me kind of come into myself.
It's not unusual that in the protection of another, you learn to find your own strength and your own stance. Have you stayed in touch with him over the years? Is that a friendship that has lasted, or is that,
no,
was that a very important moment in your life?
They moved out eventually and we lost touch, and I've tried to find them, but unfortunately Eric Siegel, they're about 8
it's
million.
I didn't know there that. Are 8 millions and many different spellings of the same
it's,
name.
It's so true, right? Exactly. And as a child, I don't even really remember how he spelled his Siegel. Right. So I've looked for him. I wish I could find him.
How is it, you described you and your mother were both kind of quiet and retiring. How was it that she discovered the resolve to migrate? It seems like in a certain sense, that's similar to your discovering the resolve to defend or be side by side with one who was hated.
I always, you know, unfortunately, my mother passed away when I was 20. Before I was old enough to really go, oh, wait a minute, how did you do that? What did you? But I imagine that it was similar, like you're saying, to my own discovery, that she may have come into thinking that I'm allowed to find freedom. I'm allowed to make a life for myself and for my children. And I have to do it myself. I can't rely on the system or another person. I just have to find the courage to get up and do this myself. Otherwise, we are going to be swallowed up by the misery that they were experiencing down south.
How did you discover chaplaincy?
You know, I always looked for things that helped frame who I was. So, you know, I knew I wanted to love. I knew I wanted to help. I knew I wanted to be there for people. I knew I always, even when I was young, had a sense of this kind of spirituality.
But you had no clear vocational direction.
Yeah. And so I thought, okay, I have to find things that are going to help me be this that I want to be. And so I ended up becoming a chaplain.
And was that, and is that what you did straight out of college or?
No, not at all. It was much later.
So I did
teaching for 100 years. That's what I really did. And I thought, and I went to school like kind of off and on. I was always in and out of school, you know, taking care of my mother when she was sick, helping the family. And later in life, I thought, I want something that frames my spirituality, that frames my sense of humanity. Something that is going to always say, yes, you're on the right track. Something that I could take and use to actually strengthen who I was as a person in some ways.
Right.
And put it out in the world. And I thought, oh, wait a minute. You know, I'll go to the school of, my first thought was like, I'll go to Fordham because they have a school of religion and religious education. And that's the, you know, even though I don't consider myself deeply religious, that is the thing that is out there that helps to mold that.
And did you come out of a Catholic background?
Not at all.
Not at all, okay.
A Baptist background. And I thought, I loved it. I loved the energy of the school. And I thought, I'm gonna take this as far as I can. And someone offered me spiritual directions program, which I have a certificate in. And then someone said, you know, there are CPE courses that give you units in chaplaincy. And I thought, oh my God, that sounds amazing. Let me do that. And then even more amazing that was ending up working in the prison system. Sure. And ended up working with veterans. Because they were, to me, they were the people who really, especially people who are incarcerated, really are very lost and abandoned in society.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Lost, lost and abandoned, thrown away even. I mean, yes. So one of the things for me as a chaplain, one of the things is trying to understand what is the context of the story. And if I know the movement and the direction of the other person's life and I can share with them what I've heard, then they can correct me. And in their correcting of me, they redefine themselves. Mm-hmm. So it's not a problem to be wrong. It's actually very helpful. Mm-hmm. And that's a different sort of way to live. I went into ministry to do holistic community development.
Nice.
Because I could have gone to medical school or law school or graduate school anthropology, but I wanted to be able to have access to all dimensions of people's lives. And a chaplain or a minister, at least in my rural, poor, white background, had that access. Now in middle class, upper middle class, pastors don't have that access. Not in that same way. So I made a mistake in terms of where I had come from rural Northwest Missouri to Ivy League educations. But I've stayed the course. It's been a different sort of thing. What is it that led you to leave then the prison? What did you find in prison chaplaincy? And what is it that led you to leave it?
You know, it's interesting. The only reason I left it is because when we were burnt out of our apartment in Brooklyn, and my husband simultaneously was getting very sick. And so when we moved here, my whole life with him up here, which was for 2 years that he survived, was literally taking care of him 24 hours a day. So I wasn't doing much of anything else. I wasn't teaching, that's where my focus was.
Right. I want to come back and we'll talk about that more, but let's cut to music. What should we play next?
Let's play Joker Man by Bob Dylan.
Standing on the water, casting your bread, while the eyes of the idol with the iron head are glowing. Distant ships sailing into the mist. You were born with a snake in both your fists, while a hurricane was blowing. Just around the corner for you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Peaches Gillette. So Peaches, you got burned out of your apartment. How long had you been together before that happened?
All together, we were, it was 37 years.
Wow. That's a very long marriage.
Yeah. We met when I was 21, shortly after my mother had passed away. Everyone in Park Slope literally knew my mother because my mother, she just had that kind of energy and aura. And she also babysat for most people. She did sewing for most people. She had packaged meals that she made for the neighborhood. So everyone knew my mother. So when she passed away, which was of course a heavy blow, I couldn't get away from people talking about her. And I needed a quiet moment. So I decided to go work in a summer camp program for children with disabilities. And Peter was the cook there, and we met up there.
What was the rhythm, the pace, the place of your relationship with Peter in your life? How did that continue to help you be the person that you are, that you've loved in yourself and in him?
Yeah, Peter similarly came from a very hard background, struggled a lot with self-esteem, and was a person who was very alone in life. And I too matched that and thought, I know this guy because I know me. And I think this we can connect. And I also knew Pete. There was another point of feeling like I knew him because Peter was very much from a very working class background. And I grew up around working class men. And so he was very familiar to me in that way.
And over those 37 years before when did he develop an illness, or when did he need
late
care?
Yeah. He was a smoker, but I don't think he was ever ill. Now he passed away when he was 75. We had about 18 years between us. 75, and I don't think he was ever sick until he was about 65. Right. And then that was it. It just progressed. He had a congestive heart failure and COPD, and it just progressed. And in the last 2 years, it was just rapid.
Yeah. And why come to Ithaca or this region?
There are two reasons. We knew people up here at the time. We had come up here many times, and we thought, oh, if we're leaving the city, at least we'll go someplace where there's some familiarity and we have some connection. So, and it's not so far away that I can't see my adopted son.
Over the arc of your meeting him, of your marriage, of his illness and dying, how was your life different because Peter was in it?
You know, it felt more beautiful in some ways, and there are a couple of reasons. One, because, you know, we certainly loved each other, and we were the type of people who felt like we were really made from one another. We had a lot of opposite qualities, but we, in the middle of everything, we felt like, oh yeah, we were definitely made to be together.
You fulfilled each other in many ways.
Yeah, really did. And also it's a very interesting thing, and I'll try to explain this. Not only did I just feel lovingly connected to him, but there was a sorrow that I felt about his life that I understood very deeply, because it was the same sorrow I had in my own life.
Right.
And it's not this, it's not like this pity, or it's not that kind of thing. It really is just a point of identity,
Sorrow is being with the suffering.
Yeah.
And not trying to escape it, and not trying to wallow in it. It's just there.
That's right. And I think that's one of the reasons why understanding that is one of the reasons why I don't think of it this way, but people say this to me, that I carry a lot of weight, not only for myself, but for other people. But it doesn't feel like weight to me because I completely identify with it. So I feel like I'm actually in part in a natural element for myself.
Right. When you are with your own sorrow and you're with the sorrow of other people, you know life mm-hmm. intimately as it is lived. And mm-hmm. that kind of privilege is the good privilege. Yeah. It's the honest, open relationship.
Yeah.
That's very powerful. Let's cut to music. What should we play next?
We play Superman by Five for Fighting.
I can't stand to fly. I'm not that naive. I'm just out to find the better part of me. I'm more than a bird, I'm more than a plane, I'm more than some pretty face beside a train. And it's not easy to be me. I wish that I could cry, fall upon my knees, find a way to lie about a home I'll never see. It may sound absurd, but don't be naive. Even heroes have the right to bleed. I may be disturbed, but won't you concede? Even heroes have the right to dream, and it's not easy to be me. Up ahead, away, away from me. Well, it's alright. You can all sleep sound tonight. I'm not crazy or anything. I can't stand to fly. I'm not that naive. Men want men to ride with clouds between their knees. I'm only a man, a silly red sheet, digging for kryptonite on this one-way street. Only on a red sheet, looking for special things inside of me, inside of me, inside of me, inside of me. It's not easy to be me.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Peaches Gillette. So Peaches, the way we got connected was with people who understood your work around racism and healing and relationship. Can you say how you have come to the work that you do now and why it's so important for you to do it now and the way you do it?
part of it is because of my own experiences with racism. I know how debilitating it can be, how much it makes people feel alone, how much it makes people feel other things like anger and resentment. What I identify with is the part of racism that make people feel alone, that lose their sense of any kind of esteem, that hurts them. Mm-hmm. And I'm always drawn toward that part of people because I feel like I get it and I might be able to help figure out what we can do with those feelings other than just sink into ourselves and get lost in it. I also believe in, and I sometimes when I say it, it sounds silly, I believe in peace and I believe in making amends. I believe in redemption. And I think that racism doesn't allow us the room to feel free enough to be forgiven, and I'm trying to help create some freedom, even though we deal with racism. It's like dealing with your own sorrows. Like, we can still function well, even under those circumstances. And I really want to try to help people come together in a different kind of way, and stop putting up walls and barriers that keep us divided. We are way too divided on so many levels, in this culture, in this world. And I feel like part of my work is to try to help close those divides anytime I can. Yeah.
You seem to have a slightly different working definition of what's most important about racism than a lot of people who do race work.
I keep getting that feeling when I speak to some people. One of the things I realized recently was that people have very, very different reasons for wanting to get rid of racism. And I always thought that people wanted to like kind of heal racism so that we can be more reunited as a human race. And mm-hmm. I realized that that's not true at all. That people have sometimes their own selfish agendas. Some people just don't want to be bothered anymore by racism, but it's not because they want to be closer to you or closer to me. But I really feel like racism, and maybe I frame things in a very different, in a spiritual context instead of other contexts. And I really feel like there's part of our purpose on this earth, whatever our purpose is on this earth, we're supposed to be walking toward that purpose together. And we can't do that if we're so divided. And so I'm always working to try to help close some divides, do some understanding and dialogue, you know?
Right. A lot of times the implicit thing that's being addressed in racism is material welfare and trying to make material welfare appear or to be financially equal or at least headed in that direction. But what you're talking about is a quality of access to each other as emotional and inspired persons to be able to relate to each other in whatever way we might find useful.
Yeah. And all those things are important. I feel like this is what I'm bringing to the table.
Right.
Other than other things to the table.
Right. And my bias is similar in that if we don't have a really working understanding of how we're living in the world emotionally and physically and how we think about it, if we don't understand each other well on all three levels, we're not going to be able to support each other.
I agree.
Or challenge each other. Or challenge each other accurately. We can have all sorts of fights, but they're not going to go anywhere if we haven't really seen each other clearly.
Yeah, I agree. And also what happens is, for me, is that part of the work that gets done when we're not coming together in a different kind of way, where we're not sitting at the table together, where we're not talking about our families together and things like that, is that it is easy for the work that's being done to be construed as charity. And when you're working charitably for somebody, you are still not seeing them as equal. And so I'm trying to create a very, from a different angle, a sense of equality that is more emotional and personal and interpersonal.
Right. Right. So let me digress for just one second. In a charity, it's a condescending, helping kind of relationship. There is no equality, but you're not talking about equality as a contractual relationship where it's a tit for tat sort of thing. You're talking about equality as a covenantal relationship where we each bring different needs and resources to the table, and we have to find a way to do for others what they cannot do for themselves, and to ask from others what we cannot do for ourselves in order to make us all better and stronger and more whole.
Yeah.
And that means you have to do the emotional work.
Yeah.
And the spiritual work that you're talking about.
Yeah. And the idea of depending on one another on a very human level is to me natural. And so we're kind of sacrificing what's really natural in an animal world, in the human animal world and animal world, for something that really just keeps moving us farther and farther apart. And we can't, and I just want to do the exact opposite.
Right. I'm going to take a little cut here.
Yes.
Do you have more time past 1:30 today, or do you need to move directly on after 1:30? Okay. So I want to close with the regular question that I would close the show with. And then if you're willing, I would like for you to describe the work you're doing now.
Okay.
Or actually we could break in and just do that now if you want.
Yeah, no, whatever works for you is fine.
This and then we'll go to the normal end question. Okay. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Peaches Gillette. So Peaches, can you describe how the work you're doing now is trying to bring people into this very real, very visceral emotional relationship, and what how you do it and what you hope may come from it?
When I think in terms of like being fully compassionate towards somebody else, being, you know, as fully understanding towards somebody else, you have to know them. You have to get to know them. And it's not, you have to know me and every person of some other color, but you have to have some way to step into their world, to step into their shoes, to step into the world, to be able to, I always thought about this when I went on a tour with a church group one time, and we did a tour kind of the major site relevant to Black history. And I remember going to the Lynching Museum and thinking, and we were watching a video, and I realized, like, I'm looking at these people who have lynched, and what I'm seeing are my relatives. I'm seeing my brothers, I'm seeing my mother, I'm seeing, and I thought, if someone else or a white person could look at those images and see their family, they would be able to get what I'm feeling and to understand the impact in a better way about what racism does. And so the only way I could replicate or try to replicate us being able to see one another within ourselves is to bring people together and listen to one another's stories and listen to how things impact them and listen to what racism has done and how it has distorted their self-esteem and how it's hurt them and how they've had to watch their family suffer through it. And if we can share those stories, then I think that we can get a little bit closer to being able to seeing our own face on the other's face.
Sure.
I really believe that. So Mike, I'm constantly working toward like really dialogue, really understanding, and sometimes a little bit like, how do we deal with racism? How do we deal with it? One of the hardest things in my life doing diversity work is people saying, I want to confront racism. And I mean, on a verbal level, when somebody makes a racist joke or thing, I have no idea how to do that. I don't know what to say. So I work on those parts too, because that opens up a sense of courage in that person that they can also actually use in other ways to
to fight racism.
So in your programs, you bring people, how is it that you identify the people to invite? What is it that they do together, in what context?
What I do is it's open. I invite everybody, and right now what I'm trying to do is keep a balance, right? Because I could always get like, you know, a million white people to sit into a group, because white people feel like they have so much more work to do on racism that I can get flooded with that. But that's not going to help them sit down with a person of color.
Right.
So I try to balance out the people of color with people who are white. And they have to be matched up. The next step is to match them up together, two people together, one person of color, one white person, and to really talk intimately about an experience that they've had and try to feel from one another, and then come back and actually tell the other person's story so that they can internalize it more deeply. So that I know that they were listening. So they know, so that they sit focused and listening. Because you sometimes, you know, like, you know, people talk to you, sometimes you're like, 2 minutes later, you're like, what did they say? So this kind of eliminates that and helps people go, oh my God, I did hear you. And now that I internalized it, I'm beginning to feel more about what you experienced. And both people, because white people are affected by racism as well. And I'm trying to also bridge that gap, that Black people have a tendency to feel like, well, we're the ones who suffered, and that's real. But suffering is one effect. There are many effects of racism that I'm trying to get to, you know.
And distortions, just complete distortions of experience because of ignorance. And
yes, yes. So, and to not only react angrily, not only react guiltily, right. Not only react angrily, but let's react in a different kind of way. Let's react in a way that says, hey, take my hand, we can be in communion with each other.
Right.
Take, you know, we, you know, a very different kind of reaction I'm trying to help bring people toward, you know.
One of the most important lessons that I learned in chaplaincy was to speak back to people the words they so much want to hear, which are the words of their own life and their own suffering and their own struggle and their own desire. And it was, I've had mixed feelings about this because there was some challenges in the mid 80s about, I was preaching a sermon on the midwives in Exodus and how they refused to kill the male children of the slaves to the Egyptian people, the Israelites, the Jewish people. And I was preaching in a chapel with about 25 African-American women, older women, and they expected me to keep a cadence. They expected me to keep a rhythm. They expected me to make it sound right.
Yeah.
And I can do that.
Yes.
And I knew I could do that. And I fell right in with it. And it was not a cultural appropriation as much as it was a respect.
Yes.
And I was a white guy in a room of all Black older women.
Yeah.
And it's probably the best sermon I ever preached because they pulled it out of me.
Yes, yes, yes.
They pulled it out of me.
That's great.
What I have learned, and this is apropos your story, is that I can pray like a Pentecostal. I can recite Jewish prayers. I can go along with the Muslim prayers. I can be present in any different sort of way that anyone needs. It is no diminishment or enlargement of myself. It is merely being human.
I agree.
How did you discover that? Because so many people feel like it's appropriation, or they feel like people own their stories rather than we become one when we tell each other's stories.
Yes, yes.
How did you learn that?
That concept bothers me for two reasons. One, because there is no such thing as not appropriating. It just doesn't happen.
It's all borrowed. It's either stolen or borrowed.
That is exactly right. And so the issue is whether it's done out of respect and whether it's done to make a connection or not. and maybe to give credit where credit is due. So I'm not bothered by the concept of appropriation. Also, if you're in the position you're in, and you get it that these people want to feel that the familiarity of what they already know, and familiarity is the first open door to acceptance, you know.
And being family in the best sense of the term. Yeah.
Yeah. It was so right to do that. And I remember when I did chaplain work at the Veterans Administration, they would send me to all the Buddhist veterans because I was not restricted to any one way of being. And so if they asked me to say a prayer, I knew how to say a prayer for someone who's Buddhist. I knew how to do that. And I didn't mind because to me, it was like the goal was the same. The want to fill that want in somebody was the same for me. I just, that was what I was supposed to be doing there. Yeah. And so I liked that. Someone said, this is what I need. And it was a healthy need.
Yeah.
My job was to fill it, not to criticize it or question it.
Right. And when you say you didn't mind, my what I project is that you welcomed it.
Yeah.
Because to be asked to give someone the words that they so much long to hear is a tremendous blessing.
Yes. And how much, to me, it's like, it transforms me. Yeah. It transforms me. It says to me, oh my God, my arms are as wide as I thought they were. And I can embrace more. Because that's what I want to do as a human being to another human being. I want to constantly embrace them and embrace what they need. And I felt great about that.
I want to shift it just a little bit. As we talk about this, telling each other's stories, it's often easier to tell the stories of suffering and hardship than it is to tell the stories of abuse and of the feeling of evil or extreme torture or pain. And many times when we hear other people's stories, we go there because they are so painful. We don't know how to hold them in the respect of those ways, those who've survived them, but we, in a certain sense, relive it. How do you encourage people to go to those places where they have witnessed or participated in evil, mm-hmm. and still remain connected to each other? How do you help that happen?
In my experience, and I did this, of course, certainly working with veterans of all ages, and the women, particularly the women in prison who have gone through nightmarish things.
Right.
For me, what has worked was really, I always made sure I made contact. Like I would reach out and allow them to take my hand and say to them, I get it. I really do get it. And you're allowed to tell your story because it is your story.
Right.
And I'm going to sit here and I'm going to listen and I'm going to feel what you're telling me. I'm not going to take it for granted. We're not here for me to criticize it or critique it. I am just here to be with you while you're walking through this darkness. That's what it is.
Right. I'm not here to judge it because your story is the light that you carry in the darkness.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's exactly right. You know, and that's always seemed to work.
Yeah.
You know, and there's something, you know, those wordless pieces of human connection, the way you look at somebody, the way you reach for somebody, mm-hmm. the way you allow yourself to be, the way you allow them to have access to you by touching your hand, those wordless human connections, they are amazing, absolutely amazing. And it really makes people, in my experience, whether it's a child or an adult, feel like you care.
Right.
That's what people will listen. They want to know you care, that you really care. you know, that you're not just like asking them questions, they just hear a story, you know?
Right. So what I'm imagining is when you work at this visceral and emotional level, that people don't tend to get stuck in ideological arguments, mm-hmm. because at that deep visceral level, we howl and scream with pain and rage, and we vomit, mm-hmm. and we experience these things in a way that we cannot argue over them, because there is nothing to argue.
That is right. That is absolutely right. Yeah. And once somebody realizes, and often people don't realize that until they open their mouth and they go, oh, right, this is my story. This is what I'm feeling. And this person is not going to leave me alone. This person is not leaving me alone right now. And I could tell this person my story, and she's not going to answer the phone or get up and say, oh, by the way, I have to do something else. I'm just there, you know?
In your work to build relationships and be aware and wary of racism, how do you witness people actually make that connection and not get lost in the arguing or not get lost in defensive posture? How do we hold this open space?
I feel like, you know, we're kind of caught in a cultural tone of arguing, mm-hmm. of pushing back and all this stuff. And for me, it is very important for me to say, this is the tone here. This is what we are not doing.
Right.
This is the way we're proceeding. I hope that works for you.
Right. And you were very helpful with me when you challenged me to let go of my experience of poverty and focus on race.
I'm glad that was helpful.
And I needed to do that in that particular way, because they are terribly mixed up in my lived experience.
Sure. Yeah. It's very interesting. I mean, for me, and yeah, I certainly can't speak for every Black person, but it's interesting how, and certainly growing up when I grew up, that class never came into the picture as a Black person. We were so pounded against because of racism,
right,
that class never entered the picture. And in some ways, there's this, you know, I'm sure not just for me as a young person, it's almost as if you have no class at all. You're not lower class. You're not middle class. You just have no class. You're like, you're below the class level.
You have caste, not class.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so that was never an issue for me. And you know, most Black people I speak to, that they just, when you grow up a certain way, it's just like, that's just not even a word.
Right. And for me, the way poverty was enforced, mm-hmm. was with applying racist language to poor whites.
Yes.
And yes. That's how the class system was enforced. Okay. Not the caste system, but the class system. And we have not found a way to kind of heal that.
Yeah.
Abuse.
It's too much. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. It's so sad. Yeah.
But that is just the beginning, I hope, of our conversations and the end of learning.
Yeah.
And I appreciate this. What would you like to play next?
Play The Stranger by, I think her name is Ingrid Andress.
I want you to look into the eyes of the person sitting across from you. How does it make you feel?
The last time we sat at the table, just the two of us, looked into each other's eyes and made the choice to choose us. Let's trace the steps of where we've been to make it feel like home again. And you play the stranger, I'll play the girl at the
last night. I asked if you would wanna dance. You made me laugh in the neon light, with your two left feet telling me you can't. Well, let's trace those steps till we can find where we got lost in love that time. And you play the stranger, I'll play the girl at the bar, the same place where this all got started. Sometimes I wish I didn't know you at all, so we could do it all over and fall all over each other again. Ooh. Let's trace the steps of where we've been to make it feel like home again. And you play the stranger, I'll play the girl at the bar, the same place where this all got started.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Peaches Gillette. So Peaches, I'm going to cut to the last question for the show now, if we can. How is it that you take care of yourself? Throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, throughout the years, emotionally, intellectually, physically, which I firmly believe adds up to spiritually. And how do you know you need to take care of yourself?
I don't know. I just, you know, I feel like I have this, like, as much as I can, I get moved to sadness and worry about where we're going is on this planet in so many ways. I also have this reserve of happiness that, and part of it is because I love us so much. I identify with our struggles as human beings, with our need for communion and family and love. And I have just a lot of happiness that comes out very easily. I don't have to fight to get it out. I think that part of it is being around children a lot, that because they're very funny people. I think I don't take love for granted. I think that love on a simple level innately has happiness built into it. And I don't take love for granted. And so I am so ready to laugh and play and things like that, in as much as I'm ready to cry and hold somebody. And so I feel very much like, yeah, I feel really fine. I feel really fine on that level. I don't feel like, oh my God, I have to drink wine and eat ice cream or anything like that.
Yeah.
And also there's another part of I don't distinguish, like most people, between like myself and others. I really feel very tied into myself and others as one in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And so my doing the work I do for others is the process of taking care of myself, you know. And I know people, we have the psychology that doesn't buy into that, but I really feel very strongly like if I am doing, even if the work is sad, if I am doing what my everything in me, my spirituality, my compassion draws me toward, isn't that a way of taking care of myself anyway?
Right.
I'm fulfilling what I need.
And in ancient Christian and Jewish thought, there was this idea that for every relationship, there is an angel. Mm-hmm. And if you want to change the relationship, you speak to the angel.
Nice.
Because that's the spirit of the connection. So the mm-hmm. care of the self means you tend to the angel of your relationship with yourself, your relationship with every other person on earth, with the organization you work for, with the household you're part of. Each has its own spirit, its own angel, and you need to tend to that.
Yeah.
And that's like, what I see you saying.
Yeah, I like that, yeah.
I want to ask this, but I also, you haven't offered it. What did you learn about life being married to a white man, being in a relationship with a white man in a world where black and white are such contested concepts? Mm-hmm. And then you were there for so many years.
Yeah. What I learned is that deeply loving one another and being together does not remove the conditioning of racism
right.
within a person. And it becomes part of the growth process to grow into somebody, the conversations about the racism that his family taught him on mm-hmm. some level.
And that he carried to his death in some ways.
And I think that because we were able, for some people who just break them up, I think that because we were able to have conversations about it and he was able to step back and go, oh yeah, I get it. And I could step back and say, yeah, I get where that comes from. You know, you didn't come, nobody comes in the world thinking, oh my God, my desire is to be a racist. It gets put upon you. And so I forgive people very easily. So our conversations were always helpful. So that was one of the things I learned about being in interracial marriage. The other thing I learned is that no matter how long we were together, we would always, wherever we traveled and went, we traveled all over the United States, that we would be confronted for being a black and white couple in a bad way. Sometimes a good way. Sometimes people were just like blown away. Like, you know, I remember going to Mississippi in like 95 and the people were like blown away that we were even married. Like, how did we even accomplish that? Like, but often we were still, you know, treated like, why are you together kind of thing.
Right. And there's
a couple because we had an age dynamic and we also had a race dynamic. So, you know.
Right. And I want to ask about that in a minute, but whether you're put on a pedestal or whether you're ground underneath somebody's foot, those are still not real relationships.
That's right.
Until they get a more balanced right. appreciation of you. And I also want to note that your marriage was an act of yourself and other care. Mm-hmm. I mean, what you describe there is like waking up to that every morning and going to sleep with that every evening, because mm-hmm. that's the reality of the life you each lived. Mm-hmm. Together.
Yeah.
Given, and how did, he was a generational older than you, essentially. How did that affect your holding each other, your being in a relationship?
I think that for me, I think that because my life was spent with older people, it didn't seem strange in some ways.
I was totally identified with people born in the 1880s and 1890s.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So you understand.
When my dad died, they're the ones who raised me.
Yeah, exactly. So it didn't seem so much like a big deal. Not to mention the fact that I always used to think like, God, what would my mother have thought if she were alive? Like, you know, like that I'm with this guy who's like 18 years older than I am. He's white. He's like, not that she had any issues with that, but it just created so many dimensions.
It was complicated.
Yeah, it created so many dimensions. I said, and what would I have thought at 21 years old, dating somebody who was close to 40, if my mother were alive, would I have deferred to her and thought she would never like this, even if she never said anything?
Even though she raised you to be your own person.
That's right. And because I was, by the time I was 21, I didn't have any parents. I had to function as my own parent, right. person. But I loved it because it actually, the marriage, the age difference, the color difference and everything, it actually opened up amazing opportunities for amazing growth in all those areas. Interracial dynamics, age dynamics, it opened up, and I love that. I love those opportunities to go, wow, how do you do this? How do you talk about this? How did people get through this? And I loved it in that way.
Yeah. And as I hear you describe that, your marriage and the angel of your marriage was like the children most people have when they're married, but they don't necessarily care for them as well.
Right. Yeah.
That's very, very, very powerful. What are some of the conscious practices that you use for your self-care? And then by that, I mean what you mean by in connection with other people.
Yeah, I think primarily it's forgiveness. I really do. I think that forgiveness is a big part of what I believe keeps me grounded, that I don't carry around, you know, you carry around hate, you carry around resentment, you carry around like those kind of things. They become ugly weights to me. And I see it watching other people, how they, it's almost like they become imprisoned in this mindset that they themselves can't even set themselves free from. And I feel spiritually free because I believe that, I don't even want to say I believe, I experience forgiveness in everything that happens. And right. And part of it is because I see our unity even through our division.
Right, right. And forgiveness, from what you're saying, I'm going to take it one step further. For you, forgiveness is the door to joy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you open that door, the resentments, the claims against the battles, that doesn't make them less real, but they are not the joy that you can know,
yeah,
or that you can have in relationship.
Yeah, yeah. I feel that way about forgiveness. I feel that way about love.
Yeah.
That you we. And it's all about a mindset to some degree. Like, right. Sure, I could look back on my life and be angry and about so many things, really. I mean, not just racism, like I was only 20 when my mother passed away. So many things that we lived in poverty. So many things that I could feel like the world cheated me or things were unfair. And I don't feel that way. And I can't tell you why I don't feel that way. And maybe part of it was what my mother modeled. But I feel very connected.
Right.
Love and forgiveness. I really do.
Right. And I want to, because you said something before that I did not comment on, but the way you talked about love is love puts in place that which is missing and gives the strength and the confidence and the courage of its presence. And sorrow acknowledges what has been hurt or harmed or in some sense lost. They cannot be fully replaced, but in seeing it's missing, yes, you acknowledge its presence.
That's exactly right. And that's very important.
Yeah.
Very important. Like that's why I'm not someone who euphemizes things that feel bad. I don't like that concept.
It doesn't help.
I just do not like that concept at all.
Yeah.
That it is okay to feel sorrow. It is okay to work with sorrow. Like, I remember when my husband passed away, people would say, well, you just have to busy yourself with other things. And I'm thinking, no. My God, what planet I end up on? You know? Yeah. I want to feel what I feel.
Right.
I love it. I do, you know?
Right. I want to ask another personal question.
Sure.
I told a friend of mine that I was going to interview a person named Peaches Gillette. He said, Peaches? I haven't heard of Peaches in decades as a name. And I was wondering, is your name part of a hearkening back?
Is it for my mom.
It's an old fashioned name.
Yeah. And my name is Irene Peaches Gillette.
That's your actual formal
name. That's my actual name. And my, and but I was never called Irene except for my husband called me Irene.
Uh-huh. He didn't call you Peaches.
He loved that name because he loved the song Goodnight Irene.
Right, right. And it is all about peace.
Yeah. Yes, I like that too. Yeah. Once I found that out.
Yeah. And my name is William Eric Clay. And I had a grandfather who was William Elmer. I mean, a great grandfather who was William Elmer, and another great grandfather who was William Harper. And my father was named William Elmer, and he hated both names, and they called him W.E. So my mother said, "But I'm having all these kids. I'm having 7, 8 kids, and one of them is going to be named after you." So the compromise was William Eric, and I've been called Eric my whole life.
Yeah, I like that. You were called by your middle name all your life too. Yeah,
that's right. Exactly. That's right.
Yeah.
And it's awkward sometimes because those automated recognition systems don't always get it. And
that's right.
But it is something that we overcome. But you also, you chose to grow into an old fashioned name that was out of step with your generation.
Yeah. It was just, everything about me was out of step when I was growing up. It was just like the intensity, the seriousness, the loving to be alone at times, just to think. And so everything, so it was just another thing that just seemed out of step, you know, and that was okay. I mean, there was a time in life where I felt like I wanted to be more like other people. Mm-hmm. As a young person, I thought I don't want to be the odd person out. Right. And then I realized that, you know what, this is who I am. And I got to work with this, you know, that's basically it. Yeah.
Right. No, and it doesn't seem to have taken you a long, long time to figure that out.
Yeah.
Or at least not from the way you tell the story.
Yeah.
Because there are some people who make peace with themselves in their 50s, 60s or 70s and realize then that, oh, it was just a lot of struggle that I couldn't let go of, but boy, it would have been different if I could have.
Yeah. You know, I think the part of it was that there's some things, of course, we have to all let go of. Mm-hmm. But what I realized that there were pieces of me that had I let go of them, it would have taken away from the things I really care about. Like it would have shattered like the fact that I felt like I was a loving child to other people that mm-hmm. I thought I'm not going to mess with this mold. Even if some of that has to be re kind of sculpted, I'm just not going to disintegrate this person that I think is going to be okay. That's what I thought. I think I might be okay like this, you know?
And one of the things I've noticed in people with a generous spirit as yourself is having a generous spirit is often scary to others. And it's scary to the person who has it because you don't know what you give away.
Yeah.
When did you quit counting? When did you discover that there was no cost to count because the resource on which you draw is endless?
Early on, I realized, I thought, what I remember as a child, I thought, or as a young teenager, I thought, love is so funny because no matter how much you love, you never run out of it. And I remember thinking that when I was younger, like, how is that possible? Like, most things you run out of, how come that doesn't happen with love? You know, like, yeah. It's so funny.
That is really extraordinarily beautiful. And it's wonderful to hear you put that together as a teenager. So what would you like to close the show with? What song should we close with?
You know, there's a song, I know it's corny, and there's a song called It Ain't Always a Cowboy. And I think it's by Luke Combs. I can't remember.
Peaches, it was wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you so much.
I
thank you too. Really. Yeah. I feel like I want to do this again.
Yeah, well, I think there are stories that we need to tell others. There's stories we need to tell together. There are stories, they're just, I come from a story-based culture background too. For some reason, I'm the one of my 7 surviving siblings that got a lot of the stories, at mm-hmm. least of this nature, of this yeah. nature.
I love it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Her hands wrapped up in mine, tears rolling out of her eyes. No messing with a made-up mind, sunsetting on goodbye. Yeah, it's hard to believe it wasn't me trying to leave this town. It ain't always a cowboy that ain't got a lot of hang around, ain't got no settle down in their boots, gone just what they do. That restless running, searching for something, leaving love in the dust of a midnight Chevrolet. The cowboy rides away. I've never seen over from this side, never heard lonely get this quiet. Still I can't keep from smiling, 'cause damn that girl can fly. Chevrolet, it ain't always the cowboy rides away. A tumbleweed heart chasing that wind, going too far. Wherever that is, it ain't always the cowboy that ain't got a lot of hang around, ain't got no settle down in their boots, gone just what they do. That restless running, searching for something, leaving love in the dust of a midnight Chevrolet. It ain't always the cat.